This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 45 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we are honored to be joined by one of the most respected voices in sports broadcasting history, Bob Costas. Bob, I think it's 29 Emmys in your career, more than any other sports broadcaster, and here you are doing something called the Awful Announcing Podcast, which I'm sure is just one more bucket list item to add to your Hall of Fame career.
Yeah, the question becomes, you had 44 guests before you got around to me?
Yeah, well, I figured you wanted to get the work some of the kinks out before.
I want to make sure you're in a groove before we engage here.
So I'm not looking to get your email flooded with requests, but are you selective about the podcasts and radio shows that you go on, or do you accept most of those invites?
No, I'm very selective. And the reason I'm doing this is that you are virtually the only podcaster who ever has contacted me. And that's one of my gripes, not podcaster, but someone who works for a site.
Yeah.
That is one of my gripes, which we can get to in a while. But you and I have spoken and we've exchanged emails and texts in the past. So it's out of respect that I do this. If anyone's interested, and I guess they're disproportionately interested in broadcasting and sports broadcasting, if they're watching this or reading the Awful Announcing site, just to be clear, way back in 2011, when Dick Ebersol left NBC Sports, my first impulse was, I've been here quite a while, and Dick and I are kind of connected. Maybe I should leave now. And when the Comcast people came in, they made it very, very clear that they wanted me to be their guy. The way they put it was very nice. You are to sports what Tom Brokaw is to news. And I said, okay, I'll do a couple more Olympics beyond the London Olympics, which were looming at that point. After which, we decided I would take on an emeritus role. So when I finished Rio in 2016 and also wrapped up hosting Sunday Night Football, I was only 64, and I think a pretty youthful 64. But by my own choice, I had moved away from that. Just as by my own choice, I moved away from hosting football in the early 90s, but came back to it because Dick Ebersol requested. That was on a personal circumstance, and Sunday Night Football was launching. I wouldn't have done it for anybody else. When Marv Albert had to be on the shelf for a little while, when they asked me to leave the studio and do the games, the first thing I said to Dick Ebersol was, when Marv's ready to come back, this is his job. And I think I did a very good job, but I happily handed it back to Marv because he's the number one basketball announcer ever, at least arguably. So I've never been somebody whose objective was to die in the booth. And his last words are back after this. And he collapses like at age 89 or something. So I wanted that emeritus role. And so when people see me now, you know, for example, last week as we're taping this, when OJ dies, there people are going to turn to me, whether it's CNN or the Today Show, because there's an obvious connection there. When the 50th anniversary of Henry Aaron passing Babe Ruth comes up, people will turn to me. And it's only when I think I have something worthwhile to say. I dabble a little bit in baseball because I've always liked it, but I'm just dabbling at this point. So I stepped aside from the biggest assignments in all of sports, the NFL, the Olympics, and some of the other things, of my own accord. So now I try to just do things where I think I might have something to offer. And I'll do things like this if the person who asks is someone who I respect. I tend to do things in St. Louis because that's kind of my hometown. And so if someone there asks, I'll do it. But I'm not standing on a street corner going, hey, want to put me on? It's actually pretty close to the opposite, because I guess like anybody who's prominent, and now with the explosion of platforms, I get so many requests that it wouldn't be possible, even if I never slept, wouldn't be possible to be able to handle all of them. So my general rule is, if I'm going to do podcasts at all, I do one a month. So you got the month of April.
It's great. Well, I do. I appreciate that. I always appreciate your time and interest even in what we're writing. I do think like what you certainly hit on something there about people taking an interest in what you have to say. And that goes for whether it is sports, politics, social issues. Like if it's something that's being discussed as part of the national conversation, I'm sure there is some outlet reaching out to you for comment. Is there any sort of pressure being kind of adopted into the role of people just wanting to know what your opinion is on any sort of topic?
You know, I don't think it's as broad as that. I was on Bill Maher. You know, and again, this predates by decades my present standing or whatever it is I'm doing, because Bill and I have been friends. I've been on his show many times. So I happened to be on his show, and the question became about Biden as an opponent for Trump.
Yeah.
And I gave an honest answer, which I think resonated with a lot of people. And then Michael Smirkanish, a longtime friend, asked me to be on his program on Saturday morning on CNN, and I am a CNN contributor, which for clarity's sake means I'm not in any of their production meetings. I have nothing to say about what they're going to cover. But if there's something pertaining to sports that crosses over into news, then they'll call upon me. So Smirkanish asked me about those comments. A lot of what I have said, and it's a small amount, about politics or issues beyond sports has been greatly distorted, as a whole lot of things are, once it gets out there on the internet or talk radio where people are just looking to make a hot take type statement. And so a lot of what my political positions are misunderstood. What I said most recently about Donald Trump, I also said that I felt that I wished that the Democrats had a stronger candidate to oppose him so that people could vote more for that guy than against Donald Trump. But for the record, I have never spoken out against any Democratic or Republican presidential candidate ever. In truth, I was friendly with George H.W. Bush, friendly with George W. Bush, friendly with John McCain, friendly with Mitt Romney. If you ask me, do I respect Bob Dole? Of course. Think about Bob Dole getting out of a wheelchair in his state at age 96 and managing a salute, one soldier to the other, in front of John McCain's casket. That's an act of grace that Donald Trump is incapable of. It would never cross his mind. So it's only with Trump that I have said things. And what I said on Smirkanish, I said that Trump derangement syndrome is real, but it's his supporters who have it. You know, that's the way MAGA media and some of Trump's supporters cast aside all the obvious criticisms of Trump. It's, well, that person has Trump derangement syndrome, or that person is a far leftist. It's a way not to consider. These are stupid tropes. That's just a way not to consider what's actually been said. So what I said on Smirkanish is the real Trump derangement syndrome is on the part of anyone. The delusion is on the part of anyone who by now believes that Donald Trump was ever emotionally, psychologically, intellectually, or ethically fit to be president of the United States. I'd expand that now, talking to you, to hold any position of public trust. That is not an anti-conservative position or an anti-Republican position. Despite cartoonish characterizations, I'm not a far-left guy. I sample media broadly. You know, I'm very respectful of people like George Will and Peggy Noonan and Brett Stevens and other names that maybe some of your viewers won't be familiar with Caitlin Flanagan or Jonathan Haidt or Coleman Hughes or John McWhorter or Glenn Lowry. If you want an informed take that's not from what you perceive to be the liberal mainstream media, go to those people. Don't go to the propaganda platforms on cable news and on talk radio and some parts of the internet. So the problem for me is not basic Republicanism or conservatism. The problem is Donald Trump. And anyone who thinks that Donald Trump is the only person that could ever put forth remedies to the border or enact other policies that Republicans favor, that's insane. It's also insane to think that Joe Biden's the only person that could possibly put forth Democratic platform, Democratic policies that most Democratic voters would find appealing. This is a choice that most Americans wish they didn't have, but those who are big Trump supporters are deluded on several levels, one of which is that, oh yeah, his personality may rub people the wrong way, but look at all these things he did. First of all, there's a big difference between personality and character. Does Trump have an obnoxious, abrasive, graceless personality? Sure. But he also has abhorrent character. And that's a factor here. It's what led him to not only lie constantly, but to put out the big lie, which he still insists upon, despite the fact that it's been refuted over and over about the 2020 election. Such a person should be nowhere near the Oval Office. And if such a person were the Democratic candidate, if the Democratic Party were under the delusion that such a person should be president, then I would criticize that situation and their delusion. So that's where I'm coming from. And to conclude this already lengthy treatise here, when issues outside sports have crossed over into sports, I've been very careful about that. At the Olympics, you can't avoid some of it. But a lot of the things that I've said over time, Brandon, are things that I would think conservatives would embrace. I've always criticized and, when possible, asked questions of the IOC about their troubling affinity for authoritarian regimes. I was on the whole sports washing thing, whether it was FIFA or now LIV Golf or the IOC. I talked about that a lot. In the Olympics, when Saudi Arabia came in some years ago, I forget which Olympics it was, I noted that they had X number of people in their delegation, but not a single woman. This at a time when the IOC's objective was to get to 50-50. So I think my thing is not to come from a left-wing or right-wing perspective. It's to come from what I believe is a principled common sense perspective. And the one thing that was most distorted and kind of began this caricature of me was the gun thing in 2012. And I'll let you jump in here because I need to catch my breath because I've gone on so long. Go ahead.
Well, I think I want to touch on a few things in there. The first thing I'm curious, because I'm always curious I point to Howard Stern for this fact, the fact that Howard Stern had a relationship with Donald Trump before he was president, and then now has loathed Trump since he was president. Did you have any relationship with Trump prior to him being president?
Yes, I did. We crossed paths a number of times in the 80s, I guess, and 90s. He was always very, very kind, if that's the right word. He was flattering in the things he said. He told me he was a big fan of mine. Every time I saw him was at a sports-related event. And then here's an interesting story. I think I told this once on the radio on KMOX in St. Louis, my old station. Sometime, I don't know, close to 15 years ago, Joe Torre had a charity golf tournament at one of Trump's courses north of New York City. And at the end of the event, it's one of those events where people pay a lot of money to play golf with Derek Jeter or then Yogi Berra, whoever. And that, I was the MC of the banquet afterwards, and they were auctioning items off. And one of the items was a year's membership at Trump National, and nobody bid. And so Joe Torre says, "Hey, Bob, you should play more golf. Why don't you jump in here?" And I knew that was the cue just to start the bidding. So I said, "Okay, 10 grand. Now, you knew that was a low bid, given what it cost to really join. But nobody bid. It was crickets after that. And so it looked like I'd bought it. And Trump was in the back of the room, and Trump said, "Oh, no, no. For my friend Bob Costas, it's a lifetime membership." Now, at this point, Trump is just the host of The Celebrity Apprentice. He's just kind of a tabloid figure around New York. Not necessarily the kind of guy I'd pal around with, but it's harmless, right? So I went to his course with friends probably a half dozen times in the ensuing year. And the first time I went there, I walked in the clubhouse and there was a locker on a gold plate with my name over on it in between Bill Clinton and Tom Brady. And they treated me royally. All of his courses and properties are immaculate. They're, you know, it's very nice to play. And one time I was playing on a Sunday afternoon with my son, Keith, and here comes a cart across the fairway, breaking every rule. But as he gets closer, I realize he can break any rule he wants. It's his course. It's Trump with a photographer. And Trump says, you know, Bob, you and I are the only two people keeping NBC afloat. The Apprentice is number one and Sunday Night Football is number two. And I say, well, Donald, I think Sunday Night Football would do fine without me, but congratulations on The Apprentice. I later checked, and, you know, this is the least of his falsehoods. This is just an exaggeration and, you know, general Trump BS. But at that point, The Apprentice was right on the cusp of the top 10. It certainly wasn't number one. And Sunday Night Football was number one. But who cares? Big deal. So he had his photographer take a picture and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so it's all fine. From the moment he descended the escalator in 2015, I knew this man was not fit to be president of the United States. You know, a lot of people say, oh, never Trumpers, as if they had a closed mind about him. Like, oh, they just hated him from the start. Anyone who saw him descend that escalator and said, this guy isn't fit to be president, has been proven right 1,000 times over. So I've never set foot at that country club again. I've never had anything to do with anything Trump related. I have no idea what they did with my clubs.
Do you know if that gold plate is still there?
I would suspect it's not, but I don't really have that much curiosity about it. So had I crossed paths with Trump? Yeah.
Yeah.
And until he entered politics, by the way, and his first utterance was a racist lie or a racist trope about Barack Obama's birth certificate. And the minute he began doing what he did, which is to debase our political and civic culture and to normalize abhorrent and dishonest behavior, this should not be a matter of party politics. It should be a matter of simple respect for what once were common principles. So at that point, I was done with him.
And then you also touched on covering the Olympics. Do you miss covering the Olympics? And I will also ask, do you think the IOC misses you?
I don't miss covering it, but that's because I did a dozen of them.
Sure.
And honestly felt that that was enough. I could still do it. I was still capable of doing it. I think NBC made the right choice, the very best choice, to hire Mike Tirico to ultimately succeed me and to succeed Al on Sunday Night Football, because he's capable of both play-by-play and hosting. He's one of the most versatile and talented broadcasters of his generation. So ever since 2016, I have never watched the Olympics and said, oh, I wish I was there. If I was there, I would say this or that. I did a dozen of them. That's more than enough. I'm happy and proud that I was associated not only with the Olympics, but so many good broadcasts on NBC over the years, and a variety of broadcasts, many of them non-sports. But I thought that that was the time to step aside. My only regret is that in the emeritus stage, things got a little sideways with me and NBC, but that's on a better path now. You ask if the IOC misses me? I would guess not, because every time I got an opportunity, I put pointed questions to the presidents of the IOC. And the very first commentary I did when I returned to HBO was a pretty pointed takedown of the IOC. And as they were going back to China again, this was 2021, they're going back to China again in 2022. And by then, everybody knew what that represented and what a capitulation that was on the part of the IOC. So I would guess that they would just as soon be rid of me.
Did you ever hear from another nation after being critical of them during your Olympic coverage?
Yes, China. In 1996, when I said, as the Chinese came in during the opening ceremony in 1996 was that here's an economy growing at 10% a year. Every nation, including the United States, wants in on that economy, as since it was obvious, has since been proven. But there are concerns about human rights. There are concerns about the threat to Taiwan. And if there is any nation that has the means and the motivation to replicate the old Eastern Bloc sports machine and all that implies, you're looking at that nation. And I also mentioned that they hope to host an Olympics. The 2000 Olympics had already been given to Australia, and they had not yet been granted 2008. But all those comments were pertinent, and they turned out to be accurate. But we know the way the Chinese deal with dissent. Just ask, you know, the Houston Rockets when Daryl Morey made a relatively mild comment, and all their games were off TV in China for a long time, and the Rockets were a popular team there because of Yao Ming. They took Celtic games off the air after, I'm forgetting his name, Enes
Kanter.
Enes Kanter, right, made comments about authoritarian regimes, including China. So what happened in 1996 was that they demanded a full public on-air apology from me, to which my response and NBC Sports response was, you know, take a hike. Nothing more came of it after that. I mean, there was some stuff in Chinese language newspapers, and there was a few protesters, maybe two dozen outside 30 Rock or something. But, you know, that stuff comes with the territory.
And did NBC fully support you in that situation?
Yes, they did.
Is it the responsibility? I mean, there's always so much debate around stick to sports and kind of integrating politics and sports. Is it the responsibility of a broadcaster, in your opinion, to mix sports or social issues with sports when necessary?
I think you have to consider what the roles are. My role at NBC was as a host. So whether it was football, mostly as a host, sometimes.
Yeah.
At the Olympics, I was the host. It's not the job of the guy at track and field or swimming to get into these things, but they're going to ask the host to do those interviews, or in the little interstitial portions in between events, never at the expense of the events, no matter what some yahoos may say, never when Michael Phelps is jumping into the pool or Simone Biles is going to do her thing, never in baseball. You're not going to talk about steroids except tangentially if it actually applies. You can maybe get in parenthetically, never at the expense of the game. The essays I did on Sunday Night Football were at halftime. There was no action going on. So that's completely BS. But the role of the host is different. And by the way, I don't criticize anybody else for what is comfortable for them. I think, for example, Jim Nance is one of the best broadcasters in the history of network TV sports. He is absolutely masterful at what he does. His choice of words, the way he draws from his preparation at a particularly apt time. I have nothing but admiration and respect for him. He is a different sort of personality than I am. I don't expect him to do some of the things I've done, nor would he expect me to be exactly like him in whatever circumstance. But yes, I felt that there were times when it was appropriate for me, judiciously, to address some of the issues that inevitably were right there. I wasn't lifting up rocks. I didn't have an investigative unit, but I certainly would acknowledge the elephants in the room. So that's what I tried to do. And eventually, before this podcast is over, we should clarify, even though it won't make any difference because I've clarified it a dozen times at least, we should clarify the gun thing.
Yes, and we will do that. I just want to, before we get there, you mentioned Jim Nance, and we're recording this on Monday, April 15th, the day after the Masters finished. Did you ever cover the Masters when it was on USA?
No.
Did you have any interest in ever covering the Masters?
No, I think I have a pretty good understanding of where my strengths and strongest interests lie, and I've never been one of those people who is like, hey, I got to be everywhere.
Yeah.
I was never an anchor monster at all. There was a period of time in the 90s when I was a good fit for everything NBC had. And NBC at one point had every big thing coming together all at once. So there were years when I hosted the Super Bowl, did the NBA Finals and everything leading up to it, the All-Star Game in baseball, and then the World Series or the LCS And then might have been called upon to do things for NBC News occasionally as well. And then, you know, pop up on David Letterman or Jay Leno or Conan O'Brien. But all those things were good fits for me at the time. I never tried to interject myself into something where I didn't belong. What happened after NBC lost baseball and eventually the NBA? So now we're in the early 2000s. So Dick Ebersol let me go to HBO because he knew that that was a good fit for me and I didn't have as much inventory anymore at NBC. But they wanted to keep me kind of on the letterhead in between all the Olympics. So they assigned me to the Kentucky Derby. And I was certainly not a horse racing expert, but we crafted a role for me that made sense. I didn't have to fake expertise I didn't have. I learned more about it as we went along, but my job was to set the scene and to narrate pieces, and that was a good fit, and it didn't get in the way of what anybody else would be doing. Same thing on the U.S. Open. They'd want me to be on the U.S. Open. But again, it didn't get in the way of Dan Hicks. It didn't encroach on anybody else's territory. The viewers were familiar with me. I brought it on the air, did some big picture stuff, and gave it to the people in the towers. So I think that was appropriate.
And then is the gun culture essay back in December 2012. If there is that the biggest, say, misconception about your career, if you could correct one misconception about your career, would it be correcting the headlines surrounding that essay?
Yeah, but it's also a misplay on my part. And it led not just to a misunderstanding about that particular issue, but because people want an easy, they don't want a nuanced and textured view of a person. They want to be able to put the person in a cubbyhole, give them a little label, and then it's easier for them to make whatever argument they want to make or to plug that person in for whatever narrative fits. Believe it or not, I think the best comp for me would be someone like Bill Maher, who, you know, full disclosure, he's a friend of mine. I'm a classic liberal like Bill, center-left person. I do not embrace the excesses of progressivism, of wokeism, some of the insanity that's infected academia, some of the policies that make no sense. Country's got to have a border. And no matter how interested you are in social justice, the most important function of government is to secure the safety and security of the citizenry. So you can't have crime running all up rampant all over the place. I don't endorse any of that. And there are many what now would be Republican, if the Republican Party even existed anymore. It's the Trump Party, and that's the problem. But classic conservative and Republican positions, and as I said earlier, many conservative writers and thinkers who I respect and I agree with. So that characterization that came out of the gun thing is just wrong. But that was a misplay on my part. Javon Belcher kills his fiance, I guess, then kills himself at the Chiefs practice facility, and that's on a Saturday. Every sports outlet in the country had addressed that at length, including our pregame and halftime shows. And with about 4 minutes to go in the second quarter of the game, I forget where we were. We weren't in Kansas City. But in any case, with about 4 minutes to go, they tell me, you got about 90 seconds. Want you to do something about this. And a producer hands me a printout of what Jason Whitlock, and here's an irony because Jason Whitlock is now a pretty right-wing guy, but Jason Whitlock had credibility. He played football. He had covered sports in Kansas City, Kansas City based. And so they handed me something that Jason had written. And I looked at it, and to me, it resonated. To me, it was clear he was talking about a gun culture. You know, forgive me for going on at this length, but this is what a podcast affords you, this kind of space. So in the days surrounding that, there was a front page of the USA Today about athletes and guns with an icon of a gun helping to spell out the word gun. The New York Times and Sports Illustrated had done stories about it. And even to this day, if you Google athletes and guns, you're going to find a litany of tragedy, folly, criminality, stupidity, And if you, in order to be fair, tried to find all the instances where an athlete with a gun turned a bad situation around for the better, certainly, theoretically, it exists. It's happened a few times, but it's outweighed by all the stuff on the other side. That's just a fact. That doesn't mean that people should be disarmed. It means that there was and remains, to a certain extent, a gun culture in the country, which has nothing to do with any sensible interpretation of the Second Amendment, and which infects sports to whatever extent it does. Okay. But my thought was, reading what Jason had written, it's obvious that that's the point he's making. That was my bad, because it wasn't obvious. Now, you could say, well, the producer handed it to you. Yeah, but I'm the goalie. I'm the last line of defense. I've got to make a decision, even if it's in a short period of time. And that decision was wrong. What I should have said at that time, and I didn't need a script. I'm a pretty good ad libber. I should have said, coming off of Dan Patrick and the commercial, by now you're all aware of what happened this weekend in Kansas City. Whenever a harsh reality intrudes upon our games, you'll hear a lot of worn out cliches, thoughts and prayers, and this really puts everything in perspective. But that perspective seems to last about 5 minutes until we become obsessed with whatever is next on the sports docket. If we're really looking for some perspective here, then this should begin a serious and ongoing conversation about a number of issues, including domestic violence. And are those who play a brutal and aggressive sport more inclined toward it than their athletic peers? What about the effects of football itself, especially if brain trauma is mixed with painkillers, alcohol, performance-enhancing drugs? We know that the prefrontal cortex is not fully developed roughly until age 25. A lot of young football players have been playing football for many years prior to that, and it's the prefrontal cortex that plays a role in emotions and impulse control. And as part of this, we might examine the whole relationship between athletes and guns. Not talking here about the responsible, lawful exercise of anyone's legitimate Second Amendment rights, but we are talking about a gun culture which makes young people trigger happy, at least some people trigger happy. It comes from a variety of directions, including the culture. You know, look at all the movies that have people blowing people away. Or listen to some of the lyrics that glorify a gangster existence, glorify the use of guns. All those things are insidious influences. For the record, when I hear about a young mother, single mother, someone's breaking into her house, she blows the guy away, not only do I have no problem with that, I applaud it. Anyone who's responsible, who has a licensed firearm, who's taken the proper training, or is using it to protect his or her home or family or for sporting purposes, I'm 100% good with that. But I'm not good with the idea that an 18-year-old kid can go and buy an assault weapon and then the next day after his birthday, blow a bunch of his schoolmates away. I'm not good with that because no sane society needs that, and it's not needed for your protection.
So was the biggest detriment to that gun culture essay, was it the fact that you were given 4 minutes warning, given 90 seconds to speak on the topic, or being handed the Jason Whitlock article?
It was all those things, but the fault is mine. The fault is mine. My intention was different than the reaction, but that was a sloppy job on my part. And normally I think I'm a more precise thinker and certainly a more precise broadcaster than that. And I've said this many times, I did myself a disservice. I did the issue a disservice because that was an opportunity to talk about the most important issue there. The most important issue there was domestic violence, which everyone could agree about, that it's a problem. And this was an example of it. So not only did I misrepresent inadvertently my own feeling on an issue, but I missed an opportunity to shine a light in front of a very large audience on another issue, which was more pertinent in this case, which was domestic violence. So regardless of the peripheral factors, it's on me. But having said that, I clarified all this just as I have with you. Sure. In the ensuing days and every time I've been asked about it since. But when people have a straw man, they don't want to give the straw man up. So I became a straw man in this instance. It wasn't enough for them. Okay, he admitted that, you know, it was a screw up, a rare screw up, I think, for me, but of that kind. But, you know, he acknowledged it. He made clear where he stands. To the extent we agree or disagree with his actual stance, let's talk about that. But if people are just intent on casting you in a way that makes it easy for them to fit you into their preconceived narrative, what the hell are you going to do?
So because of those preconceived narratives and because of the fact that words can be spun or headlines can be created to create some of those narratives, do you ever think that it's just not worth it to talk about some of those issues?
Well, as I said, I wish I had talked about it more precisely and more in line with my usual sort of presentation when it came to the gun thing. A year later, when the topic was the Redskins team name, I think I did a pretty precise job. But once the trope about the guns was in place, then in certain precincts, what I said about the Redskins was just part of my far left, you know, political philosophy. But as long as I've said what I want to say as well as I think I'm capable of saying it, I don't have any regrets.
How often did NBC give you a topic that they wanted you to talk about for those essays during halftime?
They asked me about the guns. They wanted me to address it. That was spur of the moment. With the Redskins one, they asked me, they didn't tell me what to say or what position to take, but they asked me on Wednesday or Thursday of that week prior to the Sunday broadcast to address it, which I did.
How did the owners and commissioner, did you have a relationship with them? How did they respond to some of the more, I'll say, controversial essays that you did during Sunday Night Football?
No response that I recall. No negative response. In fact, I asked Roger Goodell a number of times, some of it's knocking around YouTube, I think, what would you say to the parents of an athletically gifted 12 or 13-year-old boy who say, Mr. Commissioner, we're lifelong fans. We never miss a Super Bowl. We have season tickets. But knowing what we now know, we would not let our son play football. I posed that question one way or another to him a handful of times, and he always responded as he should have, that this is a legitimate question asked by a person in a journalistic position, and he gave me his answer. So, you know, whatever may have been said behind the scenes, no way of knowing. But no one ever got in my face about any of this stuff.
How much do you still watch the NFL?
I watch regular season games casually. I don't build a Sunday or a Monday night around it. A lot of my interest is in seeing how the games are produced and how the broadcasters do it. But come the postseason, I pretty much watch all the postseason.
How do you think Tom Brady is going to do as a broadcaster? And do you, I mean, it's hard to predict, but do you see him being somebody that does it for a long time?
Hard to say. You can't necessarily trust everything that comes across the radar, but there was a report in the last few days that said, if someone's interested in me, maybe I'll listen coming from Tom. So maybe the itch is not fully scratched. I feel bad for Greg Olson. He was nominated for a Sports Emmy in the analyst category. He's done very, very well.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin Burkhardt have done very, very well. So I feel bad for him. And there's an argument to be made that someone like Tom Brady might be even more effective and useful to Fox in the studio because of the glamour factor and because he can be essentially on every game. Well, they'll put him on the biggest game, but he can essentially be part of every broadcast because the pre, half, and post go to everybody in the country at one time or another. You know, so whatever. But, you know, it's just an example of what happens. And it's unseemly for me to complain too much because the circumstances of my life have been so fortunate. But it is annoying, and I think any public figure would tell you, it's annoying when you say one thing and the headline in an old school newspaper or the clickbait on the internet either completely misrepresents or in some sense distorts what you've really said. So I said what I just said about Tom Brady. And then the headline became, Bob Costas wishes Tom Brady was in studio. I'd never even given any thought till the guy asked me the question. Like, I really don't give a damn. It's his life. He'll be great at whatever he does.
So is that one of the biggest changes in media in your career? Just watching all of the way social media can respond to things and the way that the aggregate media can run with the headline. I mean, and I'll yeah. include ourselves awful announcing in that category, and you could speak on that too.
Yeah, you're the only person from any of these various sites who has ever, I want to be sure, if there's another, there's only maybe one or two that's ever spoken with me. And I think that it's not me. If that's the case, I'm assuming they're not speaking to very many other people who do what I do. Just aggregating isn't really reporting. It isn't journalism. And it doesn't even involve good writing necessarily. When you look at a lot of these sites, what you see is stuff aggregated either from social media, from Twitter or X, or something aggregated from some other place and surrounded by a few, in some cases, semi-functional sentences just to get it out there. I mean, that stuff shouldn't pass muster in a freshman journalism class at a community college someplace. Twitter or X exists. It's a thing. It's a factor. And that doesn't mean that everything that's on there is worthless. But when somebody just takes 12 tweets and then says, this is how the fans feel about this guy or that guy, without using any discernment, it would make more sense if that person just wrote a takedown review, you know? But the combination of laziness and stupidity there, where we'll just take what a fan site, a fan chat room of a certain team said about a network broadcaster, and we'll take that to mean that fans of X team were really upset with X announcer. You know, reasonably bright 12-year-old can see that that's not really a good formula for enlightening anybody. And another thing that happens is if you're just an aggregator, you're relying on transcripts. If you've ever watched TV with closed captioning, it's an amazing technology. But as you're watching in real time, you see words misspelled. It's just the way that technology works.
Yeah.
And I have seen more than a few times when what I said apparently wasn't rendered accurately in the transcript. And I'll give you the most obvious example. We were talking about this very subject with Michael Kay on his talk show in New York. And I said, look, Twitter, as it was then called, is a thing. You can look at it. Maybe you could derive something of value from it. But it shouldn't be treated as if it's a Pew poll, P-E-W, new word, P-O-L-L, as if it represents some sort of consensus that has been carefully vetted. The transcript said, they treat Twitter as if it's a pupil, P-U-P-I-L. Now, and it was repeated on Awful Announcing and other such sites. Doesn't an editor or somebody look at this and go, this sentence doesn't even make sense. The sentence doesn't even make sense. So what does that say about the overall editorial process and whatever guardrails are there and in place? I'm not directing this at you because in my limited experience, you have been an exception to that. And that's the only reason I'm sitting here talking to you now.
Yeah. And I'll just say that because obviously I recognize that we are aggregate media, but I do think that there is a benefit of being, or there's some value in being a what you may have missed source for people.
Yeah, I get that.
And I think that's kind of what we strive to be. There's certainly times where articles or headlines might fall short of meeting great standards, but I think the goal is to be a what you may have missed, and I think the goal is also it's to draw people in with the headline, but it's to make sure that they don't regret clicking on the article. I think if somebody sees a headline that's clicky, they click and then they regret after reading through it, there wasn't enough substance there, then I think that's always
There's also this aspect. Mainstream media, in its desperation, because it's been subsumed to a certain extent by the internet and by other means of people accessing entertainment and information, they have capitulated to a certain extent to the general ethos of the internet. So you read a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Chicago Tribune, and then come the comments. But if you had to write a letter to the editor, first of all, they're going to make sure that you exist, that Joe Jones on Sunnyside Lane exists, and he sent us this letter or this email. And they're not going to allow stuff that is just scurrilous. They're not going to allow somebody to say, I met so-and-so in Wichita, Kansas, and he insulted my sister and spit at me. They're not going to allow that, okay? But that could be comment number 27 under some article that a capable writer employed by a newspaper wrote, interviewing, you know, whomever, following basic journalistic standards. Those basic standards don't apply on the web. They only apply to the extent that someone like Brandon Contis applies them on his own. The checks and balances are not in place, as whatever the weaknesses and flaws of mainstream media have been, they came a lot closer, generally speaking, to rendering a credible version of the truth than what you find certainly on social media and what you find in many portions of the internet. I know what I was thinking of here. Just before I came on with you yesterday, I checked to see what's the last thing about me on Awful Announcing, because I certainly don't see all of it. And it was something about the MLB Network was doing an installment of The Sounds of Baseball, which I normally host with Tom Verducci, but in this case, it was about me. So Matt Vasgersian sat in, and it was the story about what's going to be contained in the show. And there was only one comment, which is fine. And the one comment was not scurrilous. This is what the comment was. Something to this effect. He hosted a few shows and did a couple of World Series in the 90s. Is he really that connected to baseball? Now, that's harmless. It doesn't matter. But in a better universe, someone will look at that and just say, you have this entirely wrong. He hosted or called a dozen LCSs.
Right.
Hosted a bunch of World Series in the 80s. Did three World Series in the 90s, has been at the MLB Network since its inception, was the first person on the air for them, has written about baseball, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if the guy had said, I think he sucks, that makes more sense
right.
than putting something out as a matter of fact. And it just sits there. Now, is it harmless? Yeah. But is it also indicative in a very small way, because it's not as toxic as a lot of stuff? But is it also indicative of kind of the lack of rigor about the truth and about context that is all over the place on the internet? Yeah, it's a small example of that.
Yeah, you could have a negative opinion about somebody, but don't base it on falsehoods like that.
Right.
I know we're running short on time here.
It's my fault.
The one thing I do want to ask. I'm curious if you did, how many years did you do later for NBC?
I did later for 6 years, from 88 through 94. And it's one of my biggest regrets that I left it when I did. I certainly couldn't still be doing it, but I could have done it for 10 or 12 years instead of six. There was a lot on my plate at that time. My children were young. I was commuting very often between St. Louis and New York. And there was a lot of preparation. I loved doing the show. And it's very gratifying that it has a new life now on YouTube and people seem to really appreciate it. It was a show that I think, generally speaking, had a very high level of quality, and it had a texture to it, wide variety of guests from different walks of life. And we had what you don't have now. No one was in your ear going, make it quick. It was half an hour with one guest. If the guest was good enough, you brought him or her back the next night. You know, you did a double or even a triple. Some guests enjoyed doing it so much they came back multiple times. And even then, in the 80s and 90s, I'd hear from guests, this is different than other shows. That's why I do it. It's not going to be a soundbite. I don't have anything to promote. I'm just here to have a thoughtful conversation. So I wish I had done it for a longer period of time than I did.
Is that a format that you think could work on TV today, or is that, are those like kind of casual conversations more reserved for podcasts now?
I think podcasts, the best of them, have, you know, stepped into that space.
Yeah.
Done a good job. I don't know that it would. You know, Charlie Rose had a show, but that was on PBS. That was different. No bells and whistles. I don't know. But
why do you say that you couldn't be doing it today? Is it just logistics, or is it something with the content?
Well, it's several things. It's the stage of my life. What are my energies? I mean, when I was in my 40s, I was preparing to do sports and preparing to interview 4 or 5 guests on a Monday in New York before getting on the 7:15 TWA, which doesn't exist anymore, flight back to St. Louis. And I was able to do all that, to do it with enthusiasm and to do all the research and to still, you know, have a bounce in my step when I went into the studio. It's harder to do that in your 70s than in your 40s. Sure. So that's one factor. But there's also this. I was connected in some way to almost everyone I interviewed. I guess I'm kind of an old soul, because it wasn't just the contemporaries. Like, let's say you're going to talk to Billy Joel or Bruce Springsteen. If I talked to Don Ameche, who I think was the oldest guest whose movie career began in the 1930s, somehow I knew something about him to begin with. Yeah. I was familiar with almost every guest, and then I supplemented it with the excellent research that the great later staff gave me. Now, today, could I interview Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran? Yeah, I could. Could I interview Drake? Yeah, I could. I could do a competent professional job. But would I be organically connected to it the way I was to 90% of the guests on later? I wouldn't. So therefore, even if you gave me the time and the energy to do it, it's not my time anymore. When I was in my late 30s to mid 40s, my sensibility was pretty close to a cultural bullseye. And now it wouldn't be, nor should it be. That's the way the world works. That's the way time passes.
Was it difficult doing a late night interview show like that without a live studio audience to kind of provide the laugh track?
No, in most cases, it actually worked to our advantage. And when we had a lot of comedians on.
Yeah.
When they got a laugh, you knew it was earned. And it was something almost conspiratorial about it. You know, Don Rickles is on, or Seinfeld, or Mel Brooks, or whomever, and the crew is laughing, and you can hear the crew laughing. Those are earned laughs. We did a few shows in front of a studio audience, and it worked out fine. I remember Gary Shandling being on in front of a studio audience. But by and large, doing it the way we did it, I think felt more intimate, and the person didn't feel as if they had to perform. Richard Lewis was a guest many times. There was never a studio audience when he was a guest. The late, great Richard Lewis. And he seized upon the format because it was so open-ended and he just free associated. And people who watch it now on YouTube say, I laughed my ass off. They didn't need an audience laughing to cue them to laugh. It's funny on its own merits. And also, I think what it did with comedians like Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld is to comedy what Tony Gwynn or Ted Williams are to hitting. Some people are funny, but they can't explain why. Some people can hit, they can't really explain why. Ted Williams could deconstruct hitting. So could Tony Gwynn. Jerry Seinfeld could deconstruct comedy down to the syllable. That's why this word has to go in front of that word. That's why this joke is better after that joke rather than before that joke. The whole thing, down to the syllables, he understood and could explain. It made him a great guest, but also a different guest for me than he was for Letterman or for Carson. And I think the audience, including his fans, appreciated that. And it was true of so many of our guests. They got a different view of that person than they might have gotten in the shows or interviews that they ordinarily would see them.
Last thing, is there one thing in sports that you would like to see happen before your sports media career is over?
I'd like to see sports journalism reinstated with full-fledged attention. You know, HBO Sports, which was the gold standard, is now shuttered. Real Sports is gone. Bomani Jones' show is gone. I returned for two very good seasons, and the show was what we wanted it to be. But the new realities of television, it's gone. Inside the NFL long since left HBO. And that was a football show I was happy to be part of because it took a different approach, and it was often a journalistic approach. Outside the Lines at E60 still exist at ESPN. But when you hear talk, whether it happens or not, of the NFL possibly buying ESPN, that tells you where this stuff is headed. You know, I've always felt that there is no contradiction between loving sports and doing a good job, if you're a broadcaster or writer, of highlighting the drama, the excitement, the shared experience, the human emotion, the characters of the people involved, all those things, highlighting all those things. I think I did a good job of doing that over time, but at the same time saying there are some issues here that deserve journalistic treatment and deserve commentary in the right proportion at the right time. At the Olympics, I always asked, and I wasn't successful, especially when NBC had additional platforms, when they went beyond the big NBC and put Olympic events on MSNBC, CNBC, Telemundo, various platforms. I suggested that at the end of each night, even if it was midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, that we do a roundtable that I would host. And we bring in sometimes athletes, but sometimes some of our own correspondents or writers. Hey, what happened at the Olympics today? What should we talk about in a different way than just covering the competition itself? What happened today? And what issues does it touch upon? And some of that could be just funny stuff. You want a show to have texture to it. But that would be a journalistic look. I recognized that you can't, at great length, in prime time, with all the investment of the rights and the production costs and everything, you can't have, even if it has merit, you can't spend 15 minutes doing a journalistic piece at 8:30 in prime time. Can't do it. But there are places for it. And I wish that we had embraced those places more. And now saying that, shouldn't be taken out of context like, oh, I'm generally critical. No, I'm generally very appreciative of the quality of the production that NBC put on and the people I worked with who elevated me and the other broadcasters. They're brilliant. The cinematography, the storytelling, that stuff is great. But I thought that there was a missing element of journalism and commentary, an element that, to the extent that existed, I was almost always the one who brought it there. But I would have liked it to be a bit more.
Bob, I could ask you questions for hours, but I know you have to run soon, and my kids are going to be home soon and probably banging on my office door. So
yeah,
hopefully I could get you on again in the future, though. But you were fantastic today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Luckily, Brandon, you don't have to edit this because it's a podcast.
Yes, so no, it's all good.
I just rambled when I felt like rambling.
Yeah.
There you have it.
Great stuff, though. That is Bob Costas. I'm Brandon Contis.
Brandon, before you go, I'm jumping in here one more time. This will be the test case, Brandon. Now let's see. You know what I said. You know the context of what I said. Now let's see how this is parceled out elsewhere. Now let's see what the vultures do with this and how close to the actual context and intent it is. I'm not optimistic.
Well, I can guarantee you that Awful Announcing will be careful with any headlines and context that we write about this podcast. I can't say the same about everybody, but I can guarantee you we'll be careful about it. That is Bob Costas. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.